has my alimony.
Doris, was that a literal explosion or a figurative explosion?
Okay, so I am here with Jenny Davidson, who is most recently the author of The Explosionist, Jenny D. Also, of course, the blogger of Light Reading. How are you doing?
I'm doing very well, thank you, Ed.
Fantastic. Well, first off, I wanted to start with, again, a typical one of my rather large, baggy questions, and then we'll, I suppose, let the conversation drift from here. But I wanted to remark on how much of the action in this book is centered around these coincidental run-ins that you often see in these Victorian and post-Victorian novels, but also novels that have this kind of great storytelling rush forward. Likewise, there isn't a lot of explicit description in this book that doesn't advance the story. I wanted to ask about the idea of writing a book that is predicated almost exclusively on storytelling, because that was the sense I got reading this particular thing. Is The Explosionist's purpose simply to tell a story? Then I must also ask about some of these philosophical asides, about whether war is necessary, about Edmund Burke coming up about the French Revolution. He remains just as Tory in this universe as he does in our universe. Were the philosophical asides, they originate from this idea of pushing the story forward? Maybe you can talk about this. That's a lot to throw you at once.
Yeah, that's a couple of different things. Let me break that one down. It's funny that you make this point about storytelling, because I've been thinking a lot this summer about how really I'm not much of a storyteller. I'm much more of an ideas person. I'm an academic in my day job, and I am an analytic, argument-oriented kind of a person. So when I teach a novel in a class, I often even use the word argument to talk about what a novelist does, even with things like plot, right? Mm-hmm. Plot is one way that you can make an argument if you're a novelist. So I feel like maybe I have the sort of semi-autistic person's attitude towards storytelling, which is because I do not naturally have the impulse to spin a story. Mm-hmm. When I think about a story and what kind of a story I want to tell, it's just, there's sort of almost no top limit for how many incidents there could be in it. You know, like I like those Agatha Christie novels that are just chock full, one thing happens after another, or the adventure stories of the kind of John Buchan model, you know, early 20th century kind of stuff. So when I was writing The Explosionist, I knew that I wanted it to have that kind of frenetic, fast-paced feeling where something is always happening. Mm-hmm. A lot of the chapters end on a cliffhanger, and I have a funny document somewhere that's basically about 10 pages handwritten of kind of questions that come up at different points in the plot, because I wanted to make sure that it was all worked out in some, you know, non-realistic and slightly absurdist but satisfactory way. I didn't want it to be that a reader would be saying, but wait a minute, what happened to that slight, you know, thing that we were curious about in chapter 10? I wanted all of that stuff in the internal rules of the novel to have its own sort of explanation. So I went through writing questions like, who is the spirit voice that Sophie hears when she encounters the medium? Why did the medium give Sophie her card? You know, all of that sort of question. And not all of those questions are explicitly answered within the novel, partly because it's going to have a sequel where some things are going to be resolved. But I wanted to be really clear on what those questions were, and I was approaching it in a quite self-conscious way with this kind of earlier 20th century British adventure fiction as a very specific kind of a model.
So one idea beget another idea beget another idea, and this was the way that you maintained that momentum. But I mean, in terms of whacking things down, unnecessary aside, surely when one is constantly thinking and associating in ideas, there are going to be an endless amount of tangents. And I guess, how do you corral this notion of idea spinning with the necessity of revision? And likewise, going back to this idea of setting this alternative universe, I mean, there are little details you give us gradually throughout the book. We learned that, in fact, the United States Civil War ended up with two fragmented countries. We learn that Tolstoy is a theologian. We learn all sorts of fascinating things, but we don't quite know exactly how everything amounted up to where we are at in 1938 in Scotland. And so I must ask about whether, you know, how much of this was in fact devised in advance. And I'm going to toss yet another question, because I know that on your blog, you had pointed out to the amazing level of research you do, often years before you write something. So Given that there is a definitive germination process here, I must ask how this all meshes together.
Well, you know, I think I'm sure I'm not alone among alternate historians in the end forgetting what are the things that I made up and what are the things that are the truth. I mean, obviously, I remember what the real life career of Tolstoy is, but there are a number of other things that I made up that now I really can't remember whether I made them up or whether they really happened. I don't systematically sit down and do a kind of sustained exercise in world building.
Yeah.
I'm doing it as I go along. And I think part of what I like about the flow of getting into writing the story is that it sparks these funny thoughts. And really, really those thoughts, those little reimaginings of real world history, for me, they were the most enjoyable part about writing the novel. I love doing the research and I love it when I have a little thing that's somehow some kind of a twisty-turny version of some real world thing. And in the original earlier draft of the novel, which was, it's not a short novel as it stands, but it was probably about 30,000 words longer. And a lot of those 30,000 words were other things like that. And a lot of what I was doing when I was revising, other than kind of continuing to focus the voice and try and get the voice really working, were to trim down expository material that really wasn't doing a lot in terms of pacing and moving the story forward.
Well, going back to one of the many questions I just asked you about the idea of concocting this alternative universe, I mean, really, was it a matter of working within a loose world here? I mean, in a way, this book reminded me very much of a Michael Moorcock alternative history, like the Hawkmoon books that he wrote, that have only a few existing elements which suggest what may have happened, but it's largely an excuse, or at least gave this... This particular kind of book gave Moorcock the freedom to essentially explore more of this notion of ideas that have spun off into other terrible, in some cases, terribly mutated forms. And I wanted to ask how this idea of world building relates to this idea of exploring ideologies, of which I plan to ask you more about.
I think that's a really fair description. And I find in my academic writing as well as in my fiction writing, I'm strongly right now sort of in a counterfactual mode, mm-hmm. where it's the thought experiment appeal of, you know, if this was different, and the thing that you make different, like in this case, what if 1930s Scotland was still really being run in a way that was consistent with the ideals of the Scottish Enlightenment? No swerve into the 19th century and these different styles of thought.
Yeah.
What if we really went back to those core ideas about rationality and the emotions? That was my most fundamental counterfactual for this novel, that the set of questions that came up around that, and what if you were a teenage girl growing up in a country that was being run along those principles, that was at the core of my interest in the topic and what made me want to write the book. So the other stuff is for fun and kind of the stuff that comes up around once you start thinking that way. But I guess in a sense, I'm not so much writing alternate history as a kind of novel of ideas type thing, where the premise of altering something in the past just lets me get a clearer grip on some idea like that. I mean, I don't know how we categorize these different genres anyway.
So you're saying that in the end, where it's set or when it's set really does not matter because it is a novel of ideas? Is that what you're suggesting here? And that the world or the alternative universe is more of a kind of fun component towards entering into the story?
Well, I think that the sense that you get, I mean, I hope the sense that you get, I'm clearly a writer who is in love with densely realized and realistic particulars that are historically plausible in some sense. So that, for instance, the storeroom with the electric kitchens and all of this sort of sense that electricity is transformative and the way of the future, you know, that's very realistic. I mean, that was a real feature. And a lot of the things in the novel that seem slightly fantastical are actually, I drew from historical sources.
Yeah.
So that I don't mean so much to say that it's a novel of ideas as I mean to say it's more like regular historical fiction than alternate history, because in fact, in very, very many particulars, the world of Sophie's 1938 Scotland is like the world of real 1938 Scotland.
Well, to talk of these ideas, I mean, to speak of electricity, this brings up the spiritual nature of the book. Madame Blavatsky is actually cited in this book as a legal precedent in which in Scotland you can enter into, as admissible evidence, voice recordings of the spirits of the dead. And the fact that this occurs roughly around 1921, I believe, in the book, made me think very much of the notion of junk science like lie detectors actually being entered into American testimony, even though it was scientifically implausible and scientifically impossible, actually. And I wanted to ask you about this because it seems to me that there isn't really much of a focus on gods or deities, but there is this spiritual component that almost takes the place of it. And I wanted to ask about these two notions of, first of all, this 1921 reflection that could have gone another way to serve the idea versus this other idea of spirituality serving as a kind of surrogate for something that is perhaps like Philip Pullman's books, which is a piss take on religion.
Well, just to use the more technical term, it's spiritualism rather than spirituality, right?
Yeah, yeah.
That it's basically in this world, spiritualism has largely displaced organized religion, although there certainly still are churches and various forms of organized religion in Scotland, so really they would be mostly Presbyterian. But so it's partly the particular point of view that Sophie's coming from, where it's her family's connections that are very strongly spiritualist. It's not that everybody in this Scotland believes in spiritualist practices instead of other kinds of Christian practices or something like that. But from her vantage point, most of the people she knows are very strongly involved with that kind of an organization. But that's another sense in which, you know, I think that there's not a lot of thinking about God and gods in the book, just because that's not the way that my personal thoughts end up very often taking me. But in terms of the material in the book, the spiritualism was a very mainstream pursuit and set of practices in not quite by the 1930s, but certainly in the later 19th century and early 20th century.
Yeah, yeah.
A lot of really reputable scientists were extensively involved in these Society for Psychical Research kind of organizations. So Conan Doyle, who we think of as a supreme rationalist,
yeah,
was actively and hugely involved with that sort of thing. But all sorts of other people were too, like Herbert Sidgwick, the famous ethicist, for instance, was very involved with that sort of thing. So a lot of the things that I describe in the novel are, again, quite closely based on real-life historical practices.
Yes.
Do I personally believe that I could build a radio that would let me talk to ghosts? No. But a lot of people in that period in real history who we would have intellectual respect for did believe that such things were possible. So,
but the question I have is not just this notion of transposition, of reflecting the present time and transmuting it into this alternative time, but also this idea of whether any of the ideas in this book were intended to reflect the real ideas, such as the lie detector versus the spiritualism scenario. I mean, was this a concern of yours? It clearly was not, in terms of the deity versus spiritualism thing, but I was curious as to how much the real world or the real timeline was a way to kind of permutate.
It's interesting, and you know, I don't feel when I'm writing that I have a hugely conscious awareness of this kind of thing, but I do believe that the present tense happenings of the time of writing are obviously in all sorts of ways affecting what it is that you imagine and write. So I guess I would say certainly this is a post 9/11 novel, and the first version of the book that I wrote, which is substantively similar to the one that's published, only I think it's better now, I was writing in, let's say, the winter and spring of 2004, and you can go and look at the New York Times papers from those months where I was really immersed in writing it, and there was a sense of the danger of terrorist attacks in public places and what it meant that America was conducting a war overseas and soldiers coming back with these devastating injuries and amputations and so forth. So there's a lot of our world, I think, especially in Sophie's relationship with what's going on. Because in some ways, she's living a very sheltered life, right?
Yeah.
She's at school. You know, she's not really you know, she's not on the front lines in any sense. So a lot of these things that are happening in her world are as heavily mediated for her as they might be for, you know, a teenager now who was on the whole just doing their thing and going to school and so forth, right?
But there are many post 9/11 elements that are in this book. I mean, it's almost
the political questions about power and violence and war and all of that stuff seem to, obviously it was coming up.
This was one of the big surprises of reading your book, because I got this sense of a lot of pent-up resentments about, say, taking away civilians and throwing them into a government camp and searches for WMDs and the like. This to me seems exceptionally reflected in the book, and this is why, again, I go back to the original line of questioning here about, how much does the world serve the needs of the narrative, and how much does the narrative serve the needs of the world? Because clearly, you can't say that this isn't in any sense a post 9/11 novel.
But to me, I mean, I say this and people look at me like I'm strange, but to me, the only reason writing a book is a lot of trouble, right?
Yeah.
The only reason it's really worth taking the trouble of writing a particular book is because if you have a puzzle or a problem of some sort, one of the best ways of figuring out a solution to it or working out what you think about it is to write a book. This is as true of novels, in my opinion and my experience, as it is of other kinds of more intellectual prose, you know? So I am not in any sense an explicitly political thinker. Like, I'm not having private email rants about politics that I don't put on my blog. I just don't have an urge to get involved in that kind of conversation. And yet, it would seem that there are some very pressing questions that if you follow what's going on in the world at all, are obviously, you know, things that you would want to think through, right? Questions about the trade-off between security and civil liberties. Yeah. That's an incredibly obvious one. It's not really interesting for me to say. Everybody with a brain knows that that's a pressing problem right now. Right?
But I'm wondering if fiction is a better depository for you to talk about these particular issues than, say, nonfiction. I mean, why is that?
For me, I guess I do pretty strongly feel that writing novels, you know, there's some overlap between what I could do in the different kinds of books, but certainly there are things that novels seem uniquely well suited to exploring. Certain kinds of question the novel is very good at exploring. So some of that is, I think, just the individual writer's preferences, right? I feel I have had a number of experiences now where I clearly, you know, explored a question first in one genre and then got as far as I could in that mode with that problem or that topic, and then I had a temptation to switch over to another mode of writing that seemed complementary in some sense, right?
Going back to one question I didn't quite get an answer from you for, because I threw about six questions.
That's right, we had question overload.
But that does happen. But I wanted to again ask you about the idea of this disparity in time between research and writing, and how much you need something to germinate before it actually becomes something that is thought out, or perhaps not so much thought out as it is just essentially deployed into the environment, and then thought out in the act of writing.
Part of me really agrees with your line of questioning and would endorse it, and I'll think in a minute of something I can say to speak to that, but I would hasten to add that when I was doing research in the summer of 2004 for the novel I'm writing now, in an ideal world, I would have then sat down and written that novel.
Yeah.
But in the actual world that we actually live in, I had to do a lot of rewrites of this novel for an agent, and it didn't pan out. And then it's years later, and you've done three or four intense, you know, revisions and so forth. And I also had another book that I was writing and a job and so forth. So actually, it would have been really better if I had, you know, been able to sit down with that stuff while it was still very fresh in my mind, is what I think. But yes, there's an element of productive forgetting. I think that, you know, you read something and you let it sit there, and it can be very, you know, useful.
But it could be useful both ways. I mean, if you forget things, well, it may force you to have these ambiguities to work within. Then there are fixed facts that may just, you can't shake away, I suspect. I mean, maybe there's a certain kind of advantage here in allowing something to sit for a while because of these particular needs. I mean, maybe it would have turned out to be an entirely different novel had you had this great sense of urgency.
There's no doubt in my mind that it will be a very different novel that I'm writing it now than if I had written it, like, on the spot at the time when I was kind of gearing up for it. And, you know, in some ways, we hope that it will be a better novel in some ways. It will probably be a worse novel in some ways, too. You know, it's
But I'm wondering if contemplation along these lines, whether by necessity or reality, is something of a hindrance. Because maybe you... I'm sort of trying to ask how your mind manages to work within these particular, this great influx of information, then further sort of stewed around and how it sort of sputters out along the other end. What are the pros and cons towards immediacy versus this long, drawn-out four-year period, for example, for this novel that you're working on right now?
Yeah. I'm stymied by that one. You saw my eyes glaze over in blankness as I went off on a very
Have you thought about this, or is it just a matter of being, I guess, so caught up within the actual act of writing that you haven't actually thought about whether there is an advantage towards one form of writing versus another?
There's a strong emotional disadvantage to being locked into the book that your 4 years ago self wanted to write, right? There is not a huge upside on that. I think it's mostly downside, you know? On the other hand, The Explosionist was always conceived in my mind as the first volume in a trilogy, so that it's not a self-sufficient story in itself. It's really the first part of Sophie's story. So aside from, you know, commitments I made to other people in the world or to readers and so forth, I do feel that the story is incomplete, and I feel an internal responsibility to finish that off also.
I wanted to bring up, because it's become this great controversy in the last few days, the infamous Margot Rabb article in which she wrote a piece in the New York Times Book Review about how her book was sold, and it was called YA, and she then received suspicious glances at various writers' colonies and from peers who are more literary and the like. This resulted in a considerable uproar in the lit blogosphere, of which I was a small part. But it does bring up a very intriguing notion of how books are currently marketed and how books are received. You have been a proponent of genre, I think, in pretty much everything I've read of yours, that it really does not matter. But I'm wondering if, in some sense, it does matter where something of yours is classified, or whether existing in a sort of genre-blind reading and writing state is really the way to deal with these perhaps needless classifications, that it's really something that we should leave to the literary snobs, or, shall we say, myopic editors at certain publications in New York. I don't know, but I wanted to bring up this question with you because I feel that it is certainly important, particularly as more authors are moving into YA, whether by desire or whether they are pushed in there. It's, of course, their own interpretation or another person's interpretation, but let's talk about this.
Yeah, I have a lot of thoughts on this, so I'll try and not just glom them all together in one huge bunch, but I'll try and untangle a few separately. Ed, you and I have in common, I think that we can say that we're both very non-snobbish and voracious and eclectic readers, right? I don't consider myself a snob. I have strong opinions. There are things I don't like, but I read in a lot of different genres, and I actually feel quite separate from any kind of a high literary world.
Yeah.
I don't feel a strong connection with it, I don't have angst over not being a part of it. It's just not my thing, right?
Yeah.
I would think I have a lot stronger affinities with a genre fiction world. We've all heard people kind of heedlessly think that they could whip out a perfectly good crime novel, let's say, and then you start asking them and you realize they haven't ever read any crime novels and they kind of don't know what they're talking about, and they're pretty definitely not going to be able to whip out a pretty good crime novel in 6 months. I think that writing a good book is just hard, you know. But John Banville must have read thousands of crime novels in his time. I mean, I don't believe he didn't have a lifetime of reading crime fiction before he wrote those ones, you know?
Yeah.
So I guess that I'm certainly not in favor of novelists cynically sitting down to write young adult fiction without having a very good sense of what's out there, you know, of what its appeal or strengths and weaknesses are, because they think that they're going to get more money that way, right? This is not a productive line of thinking for anybody. It's not going to lead to great books being out there. I feel that I personally really have the luxury of being insulated from worry about this kind of question because I am a professor. That's what I really do in my life. Like, my salary comes from an educational institution that certainly gives me some time to write, but that is basically paying me to be a teacher and to be productive in the scholarly world and involved in the research world, and other kinds of literary activity can be squeezed in, but it's not exactly part of my job. So I have a lot of freedom there. I have some freedom from the market in the sense that as much as I would love somebody to give me like a massive check for a huge amount of money, you know, I actually am not needing to make my decisions about what book I'm going to write next primarily on the sense of the market, right?
Yeah.
That's a luxury most novelists don't have. Some do, but many don't, right? If your main living is coming from the books that you're selling, you actually really do need to take into account your agent saying, you know, this book was published as fantasy, but it's got a teenage protagonist, could have been a YA novel. Next time, let's make sure that you write something that we can explicitly pitch strong to the YA editors because they're much more likely to give you a check that you can live on for a year, right? So I don't object to that kind of practical thinking. How could I? That's the reality of people working as professional writers. But these questions about market and so forth, for me, I think I would feel differently if I was thinking about writing for 8 or 10 year olds, more kind of middle grade fiction. Yeah. But in my opinion, there's no meaningful, in my opinion as a reader and a writer, my personal experience, there's no meaningful distinction between young adult fiction and just fiction, right? There are certain things that would disqualify a good book from being a young adult novel, right? A lot more young adult novels are written in the first person or in a kind of third person limited perspective with a single character, probably higher proportion written like that than of adult novels, right? Maybe the language is often a little clearer. They tend to be shorter, that sort of thing. But there's no test that lets you tell one from the other. Yeah. A lot of novels are published as one that could be another. And I read a lot of books that are explicitly published as young adult fiction, but obviously the only ones that are going to interest me are the ones that are satisfying me in all the same ways that a novel that was published as an adult novel would.
But The Explosionist did not, I think, set out to be a YA book.
No, I just wrote a novel. I mean, I wrote a novel. And Colleen Mondor interviewed me. I did some questions with her about this. And what I said to her, which is the truth, is that I really just set out to write the novel that I most wanted to read. And in retrospect, I shouldn't have been surprised that it was the young adult editors that were excited about it, because in fact, the two authors that I had in mind as like, if they had only written more books that I could have read, maybe I wouldn't have bothered to write this one, were Philip Pullman and Garth Nix. So they're both writing clearly, in the best possible sense, young adult fiction, right? You know.
I mean, I'm just wondering if all this ballyhoo about where a book is categorized is something that authors really shouldn't even bother with.
I think authors should not worry so much about it. I think we're in a really, you know, I love the internet, and I love the ways that it lets me find out about great books that I should be reading and meet like-minded readers. Like, those things seem to me great. But there's no doubt that the more commercial end of the world that we're in right now, authors have been encouraged to kind of pay a lot of attention to these questions about marketing and promotion and so forth. Some of that seems to me fine. I don't think it's necessarily detrimental to put some time into meeting readers, et cetera, et cetera. But in a way, like, there are only so many things I can do, and I'm just not interested in really knowing about the markets and these categorization. I would rather leave that to the experts, to the agents and to the editors. They're the ones who know about that stuff. Like, let us leave it to them, you know?
I mean, I'm wondering if this idea of calculating where a book is going to be classified or how it's going to be received, I mean, this seems to be a more increasing occupation with the Margot Raths of our world, this idea of where one is categorized versus what a book is. I mean, a book is sent out into the world, and when you have finished it, it is not yours anymore. It is something for the readers to mull over, and what may be YA this year may 10 years from now be considered adult. Who knows?
I mean, it's all fickle. There's no doubt in my mind. I mean, not that books could have just come out of any period, but if I had written pretty much this kind of a book in 1980, a fantasy publisher probably would have published it. Or maybe a literary publisher if it happened that I was connected in the right place and an editor happened to like it and, you know, all that sort of things. But that stuff seems to me, as much as it can have a very material effect on who reads the book, et cetera, how many people read it, all that kind of thing, and it certainly has an impact on the writer's subsequent career in many cases, but it's really, I really just don't, it's not what I'm interested in. Yeah. It's not my business, you know. I prefer to leave that to others.
Got it.
I mean, clearly I had a total blind spot. Like, I didn't, I think this is a young adult novel in some sense, and I don't think I realized that I wrote that, you know?
Yeah. Well, there was that one author who essentially kept trying to write for the market with several books, and then finally said, oh, fuck it, I'm going to go ahead and write the book I want to write, and then that turned out to be a bestseller.
Oh, you got to write the book you want to write if you want to write a good book. But, you know, I'll just say one more thing. A book that I feel this is a kind of homage too, that's my favorite novel in the world, is Rebecca West's novel, The Fountain Overflows, which is the novel of a child growing up in a family. And, you know, it's a novel. It's another favorite novel of mine is James Baldwin's Just Above My Head. But these are great novels that only are categorized as adult fiction because those are intellectual authors who had careers writing for adults. But you know, they're about the kind of thing, namely children, teenagers, family, relationships, and so forth, that young adult fiction it is often about. And they read well in both categories, and you could imagine either one of those having been published in our time as a young adult novel.
While we're on this question of previous novels, I have to remark on a number of marking points I observe. For example, Sigmund Freud is broadcasting via pirate radio to Scotland, and this seemed to me a very clear reference to The Man in the High Castle, because Bob Hope is actually broadcasting his pirate radio messages from Canada. And likewise, the Incubators reminded me very much of the early part of Brave New World.
Brave New World is a stronger influence than Philip K. Dick.
But that seemed the Philip K. Dick part of me was just, that seemed a very clear,
I've got that Philip K. Dick a volume sitting over there, and actually, I vaguely think I might have read The Man in the High Castle as a teenager, but certainly not in conscious memory, and I guess I think it's more like there's a body of just tropes out there, and the radio thing is one of them, you know what I'm saying, like from countless World War II spy thrillers that I've read in my life or something like that.
But a significant figure broadcasting by pirate radio is pretty close, though. I mean, in both cases. I mean, that's a little bit more than
maybe it's not. But I mean, but really, I didn't know about that. Like, I just didn't. You know what I'm saying? So,
fair enough.
I mean, it might have been lurking unconsciously in vague memory, but.
But I was curious about this question because it seemed to me as if these were almost marking points, so that you could kind of find your own particular way of looking at this book in relation to other books along these lines. I mean, was this consideration throwing in a particular trope like this that's sometimes explicit, sometimes a little bit broader? In fact, while we're on the notion of the subject of broader tropes, the suicide booth is clearly, has been used in almost every conceivable early golden age science fiction book, and I'm wondering to what end do these tropes serve for you as a writer? Is it a kind of a way of marking your territory, of telling the reader, hey, this book is part of your library, you know, or this particular library of other books, or how did this go?
I guess in a way, I mean, the immediate derivation for the suicide booths, though I'm sure that you're right that it's very common and, you know, widespread. It's those arguments about suicide were, you know, in not just in novel writers' imagination. Alfred Nobel's father was a kind of failed inventor and depressive, and a number of the things in the book are actually drawn from inventions that he thought of but that were never put in practice. The suicide machines are one, and another one is the SEALs that were going to be trained to drag bombs onto ships and mine them and stuff like that. I do feel that this is a book that's just sort of steeped in the tropes of like these adventure tales, you know, like, and there's a certain kind of post-World War II Agatha Christie novel that is not her best that involves scientists mysteriously being lured off to locations beyond the Iron Curtain by wealthy billionaires. You know, like, it's a self-consciously literary novel in that sense. I don't feel that I'm that well read in or well acquainted with that kind of golden age science fiction. I've certainly read some of it, although a lot of it a long time ago. My suspicion is that it's more that we all have kind of common sources in this sort of especially British, I guess probably American too. Maybe I just know the British stuff better. Like the Aldous Huxley, Bertrand Russell kind of milieu. These interwar arguments about pacifism and stuff like that, right? So for me, I feel that a lot of that stuff is responding more to kind of the history than to fiction. Although there's a lot of just thrillery trope in there too, you know what I'm
saying?
And
to be specific, I mean, I do see a lot of historical carryover, but I was just talking about the specific fictive tropes, particularly Jekyll and Hyde, which even also emerges too.
Jekyll and Hyde is crucial. I have a little afterword where I say both about Jekyll and Hyde and about Sherlock Holmes that they're essential for the imagining of this book. And so, obviously, this world of the novel diverges from our world in 1815. So really, Edmund Burke is the same in this world because Edmund Burke's writings, like Jane Austen's writings, were written and published, you know, like before the point of divergence or whatever, right? Now, I really have cheated and I'm not a real alternate historian would be outraged by some of the things that I've done because there's clearly much more entanglement between the two worlds than I really have any interest in philosophically explaining, right?
Yeah.
And in particular, it seemed to me that Jekyll and Hyde, it's a story that I've known for so long and has so strongly affected my sense of Edinburgh and, you know, all sorts of other things to do with human personality that even though it was written and published long after the points of divergence and there's no sensible explanation of why it exists in this world as well as in ours, it just seemed to me like it had to exist. And the same for the Sherlock Holmes stories, that they just have to. Like, they can't not exist. They have to be there.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I also wanted to ask you about the many explanation marks as well as the italicized words that often come up and sustain what I would probably identify as a quite giddy narrative. They're used in, I think, just the amount of judicious frequency, in the sense that they're never too frequent, but there are just enough of them for you to kind of, I guess, perk yourself up and get caught up in the story. Did you think in terms of how many explanation points you were going to use?
No, but my editor at HarperCollins, Ruth Katcher, is a great literary genius and was very good in terms of being very attentive to minor questions of tone. So, and a lot of people have read this and helped me figure out where it was annoyingly over the top or where, you know, where it should be toned down. I guess I would say more immediately, I do really like exclamation points, and I feel that really I certainly learned as an adolescent that they were in poor taste and that one was not conventionally meant to use them either in academic prose or in fiction writing and so forth. So in a sense, you could say that the exclamation sums up why it's better for me to be whether it's a genre writer or a YA writer or whatever than a literary fiction writer, because I think that probably if you did an unofficial poll of some prominent literary novelists of our generation and you asked them what their position was on exclamation points, they would still be largely disapproving. And I think that that's a pity.
It really is. I agree.
It depends on your personality. Some people need them more than others. And I think that my personality means that I need them more than some other people might. But you see what I'm saying?
Yeah, I do. But I mean, how over the top did you go in initial drafts? I mean, I note that many of the explanation points occur within dialogue.
Actually, not so much. I'm slightly joking here. I don't feel my vice as a writer is much more like the huge chunks of expository prose. Like that's more like where I need someone saying, you know, it's funny in itself, but just cut it. Like, it just isn't helping. The tone stuff is something I'm interested in, and it's associated it's associated with the perspective of that character of Sophie and her point of view, you know.
That's really interesting what you say about exposition, because I was going to ask you about how the phrasing of some of these sentences is often a little bit in this. Again, this is why I thought of Michael Moorcock, because he does this as well, in particularly in those books that he wrote in the 60s, where it has this almost slightly instructive but also very kind of cockamamie way of explaining what is going on. And I was wondering how this came about.
But, you know, I cannot consciously... Again, I must have read a novel or two by Michael Moorcock. Like, it would be implausible that I wouldn't have. But I certainly couldn't tell you a specific one that I definitely have read. And it all would have been a very long time ago. Why is that such a natural and comfortable mode for me to write in? That's one of the mysteries of life. But it is true that I was born in England, and although I moved to America when I was about 2.5, and I then learned to get rid of my English accent and have a thoroughly American way of growing up in the world, I do feel that for me, there was a kind of charge, you know, like the British grandparents would send over these British children's books that often in many cases were from more like the 30s and 40s and 50s, were not even contemporary, you know, British children's books and so forth. So there's something nostalgic, I guess, maybe.
Yeah.
I gravitate to British children's literature of a slightly earlier feeling age or something like that.
The sense I'm getting, then, is that The Explosionist is, in a large sense, something of a mashup, because I do know you read perhaps faster than almost anybody I know.
But you
go through books like the rest of us actually
go through
Oxygen. And
I always have this image of, like, the wood chipper, you know, like where you throw in the stuff and, like, the chips sort of fly out, and it's really hard to keep it supplied. Like, that's what I feel like about my reading habits.
But in light of The Explosionist, which I see, and we've sort of discussed, is very much informed by tropes, by reading, by research, by other books. Where is the, I guess, ratio for invention here? Where is the ratio for ambiguity? Or is it such a... Do the books latch onto your brain and your heart and your soul?
The books latch onto my brain and my heart and my soul. And, you know, it definitely... It would be bad if everybody who wrote novels was like me, because then all books would be much too much steeped in other books and not, you know, with the whole range of human experience. But I actually thought this more specifically about the classroom scenes in The Explosionist. I like about the Harry Potter books that I feel that J.K. Rowling reclaimed the classroom as a place where it's acceptable to set scenes in popular fiction.
Yeah.
You know, I don't think that there was a consensus on that beforehand. And I think, you know... I'm not married. I don't have any kids. I'm slightly a recluse. A lot of the most interesting hours of my average week are the hours that I spend in a classroom with my students. Those are stimulating, unpredictable, interesting, challenging hours. So why would I write a novel that would be about like the immediacy of certain other kinds of experience that are not actually at all the interesting and exciting parts of my life? If my life is very much about excitement about books and ideas and classroom scenes and, you know, the whole particular set of things that is the way that I live in the world, I would be crazy not to try and find a kind of book to write that would actually be that book rather than some totally other book.
I'm going to disagree with you just a little bit here, because I think, for example, one thing that I was struck by was, for example, the two boy characters, that they have this incredible enthusiasm to them, this passion that allows them to grow as characters. Keith, for example, is the great photographic genius, and Mikhail is aspiring to be a detective. And because you have this particular idea, it allows, I suspect, your ability to invent to grow, and as a result, these characters take on an additional kind of life. In fact, that was one thing that struck me about the book was that I talk with a lot of authors, and one of the interesting things that fascinates me is how good they are at both particular genders. And I felt that you were equally good at both genders in this, because you were able to imbue them with this almost conceptual sense of enthusiasm that then latched on and became its own little beast that grew and became flesh and blood within the course of a narrative. Not only that, but we're also dealing with a medium that is essentially nothing but artifice. So I don't necessarily believe that you entirely have to keep things
real.
Oh,
yeah. And, I think another thing that I would say that is an honest and truthful observation is that, I think when I was setting out to write the book, I had a clear idea of certain fixed points in it, and particularly the first half, I had a pretty clear idea of the kind of sequence of incidents. The second half was much more of a blank. There were a couple big scenes, showdown-y kind of scenes I could imagine, but I didn't have a clear sense at all of what was going to be happening. And the thing that was probably the most... Sometimes it's very coy and affected when writers talk about their characters, and I don't want to be like that, but the thing that was the most surprising to me, like where I was genuinely taken aback at the scenes that I was writing and how interesting they seemed to me, and it wasn't what I thought, was the scenes of the tension between the girls who were roommates at school. Yeah. Like, none of that was even... I mean, I had a sense of these four girls and that there were some tensions, but, I really didn't have any particular sense of what they would be doing or plots and so forth. So all of that line of development of the tensions building and of... of what happens between those characters was a total surprise to me. Yeah. And I was really genuinely taken aback at the way that it seemed to actually be a sort of emotional center in the second half of the book. It wasn't what I was imagining. Huh.
I'm wondering if dialogue helped you to get this sense of, I suppose, life of this, you were complaining and I was about this idea that, oh, well, I only have a limited scope to with which to view the world. I mean, which I don't know if I entirely believe that, but nevertheless, when you have...
It's not so much a question of limited scope as a question about emphasis. Like, I say regularly on my blog that I like Muriel Spark because she is the great novelist of the small group, that given the whole distribution of different kinds of social configuration that you could write about, a lot of people write about marriages, families, and so forth. Not to knock them, we want books like that too, but Muriel Spark wrote a whole series of novels that are set in schools, convents, boarding houses, right? She had a particular interest, almost a kind of sociologist's interest, in the dynamic of that configuration instead. And so it's more just like, I would like more books like that. You know what I'm saying?
Sure. There is one other question I wanted to ask you about, and that is the fact that, going back to this dialogue, a lot of it is written in a rather accessible general English vernacular. It's not specifically Scottish, with the exception of "Where's my money?" That whole scenario. Okay, well, finally we get a little bit of Scottish dialogue in here. But I'm curious why you abstain from perhaps having...
I have more Scottish dialect, and that might have been one thing that did get changed partly. Well, maybe it's partly just because I'm not good at it, but maybe it's partly for the young adult readership, just making sure it wasn't... Well, it's a question of taste. I guess I think I wrote... I had some more characters... The housekeeper, for instance, in earlier drafts spoke much more strongly in a Scottish dialect. But although I feel very comfortable with the sound of different kinds of Scottish spoken English, I do think that really I'm not as comfortable writing that kind of dialect as something a little bit more, neutral. And there's a class component in this Scottish setting too, right, where... It's a fact about the society that I'm writing about that the girls who are from these better off, more well-off professional kind of families, they'll have a strong Scottish accent, but and there would certainly be peculiarities of diction and so forth that might be distinctly Scottish, but they're speaking a much more standard English than the lower class speakers whose voices are more strongly marked with a kind of Scots vocabulary or something like that.
But this question of writing in comfort, I mean, there is one uncomfortable moment with the medium, which I won't quite reveal because I do want to be a shock for the readers, that is decidedly uncomfortable. And I know also you've written a previous book that has a lot of disturbing imagery in it. And I'm wondering, it seems to me that there are certain parts that certain acts of writing for you that are that in which you have to be comfortable and kind of play it with the kind of knowledge that you know, and other parts of your writing that in which you willfully delve into uncomfortable territory. I'm curious as to why there's this hesitation.
Maybe I should introduce a different phrase, which is authentic or truthful, something like that. So just as a matter of style, I feel, I don't know whether you want to use the metaphor of the eye or the ear. I'm a very eye-based reader. Like, I read quickly, and I definitely feel I'm strongly reading through my eyes. But for the test of sort of, and when I'm reading something to edit someone else's writing, my eye jumps to errors. But when I'm writing anything, fiction or academic writing, I have a very stringent test of whether it matters to me that things should be truthful, not truthful like accurate historically, but truthful like, is this a sentence that I really can stand by that does not have anything coy or disingenuous or melodramatic or sentimental about it, right? So it's a almost ethical question about truthfulness, emotional ethical question about truthfulness that seems to me to be very clearly phrased in terms of style. So I always, at least probably 4 or 5 times with every book that I've written, for each book, just literally am reading out loud to myself the whole thing to see if it sounds right to me, like to see if that's really, like, it, you know, in an academic book, it's like, is that just a rhetorically extravagant, flourishy sentence that I wrote because I kind of like how it sounds, but I can't really stand by? Well, if it is, like, let's cut that out. And so for a novel, it comes more around these questions of, is this really the way a real person would talk?
Yeah.
Well, I'm writing in a kind of thrillery mode where actually people don't really have to talk like they really talk in real life. You know what I'm saying? Like, there's a stylized quality to it that I'm happy with. I'm not saying that I'm going for some kind of a really hardcore ethos of like realism or something like that. But if I write sentences in Scottish dialect, there's something embarrassing about that. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Like, embarrassing, not like I should take a risk and risk embarrassment, but just embarrassing in a bad way. Like,
in an ethical
isn't this
sense.
A little, well, no, in a stylistic sense. Like, isn't this cliche? Isn't this, is this really, does, you know what I'm saying? Does it really sound
I'm
right?
Curious still about this relationship between style and ethics. I mean, I really want to hear more about this, but what would be an example aside from, say, for example, writing in a Scottish dialect for you? I mean, just having an excessively Baroque or ornate sentence or something that's showy? Or?
It's easy for me, if I was taking some people's quite good academic writing even, to point to it there. Because it's this sense of doing things that are, there's a whole range of different kinds of showiness that would strike, for me as a writer, they would be inauthentic, you know?
Yeah. So,
ironically, I love the writings of Edmund Burke. Like, I just love that guy's stuff. And Burke is a very showy writer. I mean, a famous in the Reflections on the Revolution in France, he's working himself up to rhetorical flights of fancy. And everybody who knew him who read it, even his friends said, you know, you're working yourself up to this. Why should we buy it? But Thomas Paine had a famous line about what Burke was doing there in that book where he said, he pities the plumage but forgets the dying bird. You know, so now we're slightly off topic, but I, you know, there are certain, I've had this argument many a time. I don't know if I can persuade you on this. There are certain emotions that are, it seems to me, antithetical to good writing. Like, self-pity is one of them. Sometimes a writer has an orientation towards a character that is too, like, let's say there's a character in I can't think of an example off the top of my head, but let's say a novelist writes a pretty accomplished novel in which there's a character who has a lot in common life-wise and situation-wise and emotionally with the novelist, and the novelist is enveloping that character in a kind of blanket of protective, sort of respectful, kind of dramatizing prose, right? That every emotion of the character is taken with the utmost seriousness and even perhaps slightly overinflated by the novelist.
I see what you're saying.
That's the kind of sentence. And And often I think those sentences, I've just explained in a psychological way what my objection is to it, but often there are symptoms in the literary style of this kind of a distortion of relationship, right? Like where a novelist may be so strongly identified with a character that they have become blind to the kind of rationalizing or self-justifying elements of the prose or something like that. Do you know what I'm saying?
So when the actual prose itself almost cancels out the motivations of the character.
When the prose... Okay. I might say about a person that they are histrionic. It's hard for me to imagine a good paragraph of prose about a character, however histrionic the character might be, where the prose was also histrionic, right?
Yeah.
In order to do a really good depiction of a histrionic character, the prose cannot participate in the character's histrionicness. Well, we can imagine kinds of novel that might find an interesting way around the stipulation, right? None of these are going to be rules that can be like enforced thoroughly and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
I then have to ask you about, like, for example, Kate Atkinson's Jackson Brody novels, which I love. The Jackson Brody voice is written in a way in which the prose absolutely matches the ironies of this character's inability to see what is in front of him. This very hilarious, at times, ignorance about the world. I mean, would you say that is ethically sound because the prose works?
I've only read the first one, and it's a little while ago, but I share your opinion that it's a good novel, and I think she's a good writer. I think she's a very cunning stylist. I mean, I do think of her as a stylist, and I think she was paying attention to what she was doing there, you know?
But I mean, you know, is this really a fair charge to make? Because a lot of writers, even the most elaborate and in many cases ostentatious, depending upon your perspective, writers, they will use prose in this manner and they have no other way of speaking.
But this is somewhat speculative because this isn't what I've read recently at all either, but this could be a way of distinguishing between Hemingway at his best and Hemingway at his worst, right? In Hemingway's best fiction, the style has a quality to it that means that you can't just say, oh, these books aren't really valuable to us anymore because they're so, they're just doing these masculine myths that are bogus and melodramatic and so forth, right? But on the other hand, there are days when Hemingway is not at his best or books where he's weaker, where the register somehow tips over, where the language becomes less accurate and less honest. And a bit more myth-making in a non-self-aware way. You know what I'm saying? Like, not that you couldn't write a myth-making novel, but that there's a kind of...
He became more aware of his style, more conscious of what he was doing, in a way that almost became absurd. Hunter S. Thompson would fall into this particular category. A lot of writers, David Foster Wallace to some degree, they became so aware of what they were doing that they became almost self-parodies in some sense. And the magic that initially attracted us to them in their early books, when they were blissfully unaware, is this what we're talking about here?
I don't think it's usually something that authors are so consciously aware of. I guess I do feel, though, that for me, some notion of honesty and the ethical as it's linked to style is a worthwhile criterion, and that it has something to do that I'm trying to think of what would be a better example that I would have more concrete versions of. Or, you know, Dickens is a novelist I know really well. Like, I love Dickens. Dickens and Austen are really my utter favorites in the whole English novel tradition. But the best Dickens novels are really uncompromising and honest. I mean, David Copperfield, that's a novel that's actually... I mean, David Copperfield is unflatteringly depicted in that first person novel, right? He is not, in many ways, an attractive character. But there are other Dickens novels where there's a kind of, what the narrative or the narrative voice is doing is more like somehow glorifying or making heroic a character. Do you know what I'm saying? I think I'm just very suspicious of that. I want a plainer and more honest relationship. And I think that I think novelists can get into trouble when they don't think a little bit about that stuff.
But to turn this ethical question back to you.
Yeah.
You're writing a novel at a particular time in your life. 4 years down the line, you may be in a completely different spot. You may not be able to justify particular sentences with this ethical criteria that you did 4 years earlier. How do you deal with this? I mean, how does this affect your
development? Well, that's just part of being a future-oriented person more generally, because, I mean, surely I am not alone in writers and, like, looking at the old books I wrote and thinking, ugh, you know, and wanting to write new ones that are as yet unwritten.
Yeah.
And that, I mean, it's the universal part of the writerly condition that the sentences that you have not written have this kind of purity and glow on them that, you know, as much as you strive to make the sentences that you actually publish,
yeah,
like, have that feel of sharpness and freshness of observation or whatever that you want, that really, like, it's always ever onward and upward. Like, the next one always seems like it's going to be better than the last one.
Got it. Well, Jenny, it was a pleasure chatting with you. Thank
yes,
you so
thank
much
you
for taking
so much
the time.
For taking the time yourself. Yes,
thank you.
It's just that we never really made it that far west. Yeah, we scored big in Denver, but we thought it might be best to go hang around in the upper Midwest.